Chapter 24. The night spent by Levin on the haycock didn't pass without leaving its mark. The way in which he had been managing his land revolted him and had lost all attraction for him. In spite of the magnificent harvest, never had there been, or at least never it seemed to him had there been, so many hindrances and so many quarrels between him and the peasants as that year. And the origin of these failures and this hostility was now perfectly comprehensible to him. The delight he had experienced in the work itself, and the consequent greater intimacy with the peasants, the envy he felt of them, of their life, the desire to adopt that life which had been to him that night not a dream, but an intention, the execution of which he had thought out in detail, all this had so transformed his view of the farming of the land as he had managed it, that he couldn't take his former interest in it, and couldn't help seeing that unpleasant relation between him and the workpeople which was the foundation of it all. The herd of improved cows such as Parva, the whole land ploughed over and manured, the 9 level fields surrounded with willows, the 240 acres heavily manured, the seed drills and all the rest of it. It was all splendid. If only the work had been done for themselves, or for themselves and comrades, people in sympathy with them. But he saw clearly now, his work on a book of agriculture in which the chief element in husbandry was to have been the labourer, greatly assisted him in this, that the sort of farming he was carrying on was nothing but a cruel and stubborn struggle between him and the labourers, in which there was on one side, his side, a continual intense effort to change everything to a pattern he considered better, on the other side, the natural order of things. And in this struggle, he saw that with immense expenditure of force on his side, and with no effort or even intention on the other side, all that resulted was that the work did not go to the liking of either side, and that splendid tools, splendid cattle, and land were spoiled with no good to anyone. Worst of all, the energy expended on this work was not simply wasted. He couldn't help feeling now, since the meaning of this system had become clear to him, that the aim of his energy was a most unworthy one. In reality, what was the struggle about? He was struggling for every kopeck of his share, and he couldn't help it, for he had only to relax his efforts, and he wouldn't have had the money to pay his labourers' wages. While they were struggling only to be able to do their work easily and agreeably, that is to say, as they were used to doing it. It was for his interests that every labourer should work as hard as possible, and that while doing so, he should keep his wits about him, so as not to try to break the winnowing machines, the horse rakes, the threshing machines, that he should attend to what he was doing. What the labourer wanted was to work as pleasantly as possible, with rests, and above all, carelessly and heedlessly, without thinking. That summer, Levin saw this at every step. He sent the men to mow some clover for hay, picking out the worst patches where the clover was so overgrown with grass and wormwood, and of no use for seed. And again they mowed the best acres of clover, justifying themselves by the pretense that the bailiff had told them to, and trying to pacify him with the assurance that it would be splendid hay. But he knew that it was because those acres were so much easier to mow. He sent out a hay machine for pitching the hay. It was broken at the first row, because it was boring work for a peasant to sit on the seat in front with the great wings waving above him. And he was told, "Don't trouble, sir. Sure that the women will pitch it quick enough." The ploughs were practically useless, because it never occurred to the labourer to raise the share when he turned the plough, and forcing it around, he strained the horses and tore up the ground, and Levin was begged not to worry. The horses were allowed to stray into the wheat, because not a single labourer would consent to be a night watchman, and in spite of orders to the contrary, the labourers insisted on taking turns for night duty, and Ivan, after working all day long, fell asleep, and was very penitent for his fault, saying, "Do what you will to me, Your Honour." They let 3 of the best calves die by letting them into the clover without any water to drink, and nothing would make the men believe that they had been swelled up by the clover, but they told him by way of consolation that one of his neighbours had lost 112 head of cattle in 3 days. All this happened not because anyone felt ill-will toward Levin or his farm. On the contrary, he knew that they liked him, thought him a simple gentleman, their highest praise. But it happened simply because all they wanted was to work merrily and carelessly. and his interests were not only remote and incomprehensible to them, but fatally opposed to their most just claims. Long before, Levin had felt dissatisfaction with his own position in regard to the land. He saw where his boat leaked, but he didn't look for the leak, perhaps purposely deceiving himself. But now he could deceive himself no longer. The farming of the land, as he was managing it, had become not merely unattractive, but revolting to him, and he could take no further interest in it. To this, now, was joined the presence, only 25 miles off, of Kitty Shishchobatskaya, whom he longed to see and couldn't see. Darya Alexandrovna Oblonskaya had invited him, when he was over there, to come. To come with the object of renewing his proposal to her sister, who would, so she made him understand, accept him now. Levin himself had felt, on seeing Kitty Shishchobatskaya, that he had never ceased to love her. But he couldn't go over to the Oblonskys, knowing she was there. The fact that he had proposed and that she had refused him had placed an insuperable barrier between her and him. "I can't ask her to be my wife merely because she can't be the wife of the man she wanted to marry," he said to himself. The thought of this made him cold and hostile toward her. "I won't be able to speak to her without a feeling of reproach. I couldn't look at her without anger, and she will only hate me all the more, as it's right she should. And besides, how can I now, after what Darya Alexandrovna told me, go see them? Can I help showing that I know what she told me? And to go magnanimously to forgive her and have pity on her? Me, go through a performance before her of forgiving and deigning to bestow my love on her? What induced Darya Alexandrovna to tell me that? By chance I might have seen her. Then everything would have happened naturally. But as it is, it's out of the question. Out of the question." Darya Alexandrovna sent him a letter asking him for a side saddle for Kitty's use. "I'm told you have a side saddle," she wrote to him. "I hope you'll bring it over yourself." This was more than he could stand. How could a woman of any intelligence, of any delicacy, put her sister in such a humiliating position? He wrote 10 notes and tore them all up, and sent the saddle without any reply. To write that he would go was impossible, because he couldn't go. To write that he could not come, because something prevented him, or that he would be away, that was still worse. He sent the saddle without an answer, and with a sense of having done something shameful. He handed over all the now revolting business of the estate to his bailiff, and set off the next day to a remote district to see his friend Shiavsky, who had splendid marshes for snipe in his neighbourhood, and had lately written to ask him to keep a long-standing promise to stay with him. The snipe marsh in the Sarovsky district had long tempted Levin, but he had continually put off this visit because of his work on the estate. Now he was glad to get away from the neighbourhood of the Shishchobatskys, and most of all from his farm work, especially on a shooting expedition, which always served as the best consolation in all his troubles. Chapter 25. In the Sarovsky district, there was no railway or service of post-horses, and Levin drove there with his own horses in his big, old-fashioned carriage. He stopped halfway at a well-to-do peasant's to feed his horses. A bald, well-preserved man, with a broad red beard, grey on his cheeks, opened the gate, squeezing against the gatepost to let the three horses pass. Directing the coachman to a place under the shed, in the big, clean, tidy yard with charred, old-fashioned ploughs in it, the old man asked Levin to come into the parlour. A cleanly dressed young woman, with galoshes on her bare feet, was scrubbing the floor in the new outer room. She was frightened of the dog which ran in after Levin, and uttered a shriek, but began laughing at her own fright at once when she was told the dog wouldn't hurt her. Pointing Levin to the door into the parlour with her bare arm, she bent down again, hiding her handsome face, and went on scrubbing. "Would you like the samovar?" she asked. "Yes, please." The parlour was a big room, with a Dutch stove and a partition dividing it into two. Under the icons stood a table painted in patterns, a bench and two chairs. Near the entrance was a dresser full of crockery. The shutters were closed. There were few flies, and it was so clean But Levin was anxious that Laska, who had been running along the road and bathing in puddles, should not muddy the floor, and ordered her to a place in the corner by the door. After looking around the parlour, Levin went out in the backyard. The good-looking young woman in galoshes, swinging the empty pails on the yoke, ran on before him to the well for water.
"Look alive, my girl!"
the old man shouted after her merrily, and he went up to Levin.
"Well, sir, are you going to Nikolai Ivanovich Yasky? His honour comes to us, too," he began chatting, leaning his elbows on the railings of the steps.
In the middle of the old man's account of his acquaintance with Shevatsky, the gates creaked again, and labourers came into the yard from the fields with wooden ploughs and harrows. The horses, harnessed to the ploughs and harrows, were sleek and well-fed. The labourers were obviously of the household. Two were young men in cotton shirts and caps. The two others were hired labourers in homespun shirts, one an old man, the other a young fellow. Moving off from the steps, the old man went up to the horses and began unharnessing them.
"What have they been ploughing?" asked Levin. "Ploughing up the potatoes. We rent a bit of land, too. Fedot, don't let out the gelding, but take it to the trough, and we'll put the other in harness." "Oh, father, has he brought the ploughshares I ordered?" asked the big, healthy-looking fellow, obviously the old man's son. "There, in the outer room," answered the old man, bundling together the harness he had taken off and flinging it on the ground. "You can put them on while they have dinner."
The good-looking young woman came into the outer room with the full pails dragging at her shoulders. More women came on the scene from somewhere, young and handsome, middle-aged, old and ugly, with children and without children. The samovar was beginning to sing. The labourers and the family, having disposed of the horses, came in to dinner. Levin, getting his provisions out of his carriage, invited the old man to have tea with him.
"Well, I have had some today already," said the old man, obviously accepting the invitation with pleasure. "But just a glass for company."
Over their tea, Levin heard all about the old man's farming. 10 years before, the old man had rented 300 acres from the lady who owned them, and a year ago he had bought them and rented another 300 from a neighbouring landowner. A small part of the land, the worst part, he rented out, while 120 acres of arable land he cultivated himself with his family and 2 hired labourers. The old man complained that things were going badly, but Levin saw that he simply did so from a feeling of propriety, and that his farm was in a flourishing condition. If it had been unsuccessful, he wouldn't have bought land at 35 rubles an acre. He wouldn't have married off his 3 sons and the nephew. He wouldn't have rebuilt 2x after fires, and each time on a larger scale. In spite of the old man's complaints, it was evident that he was proud, and justly proud, of his prosperity. Proud of his sons, his nephew, his sons' wives, his horses and his cows, and especially of the fact that he was keeping all this farming going. From his conversation with the old man, Levin thought he was not averse to new methods either. He had planted a great many potatoes, and his potatoes, as Levin had seen driving past, were already past flowering and beginning to form fruit, while Levin's were only just coming into flower. He earthed up his potatoes with a modern plough borrowed from a neighbouring landowner. He sowed wheat. The trifling fact that thinning out his rye, the old man used the rye he thinned out for his horses, specially struck Levin. How many times had Levin seen this splendid fodder wasted and tried to get it saved? But always it had turned out to be impossible. The peasant got this done, and he couldn't say enough in praise of it as food for the beasts.
"What have the wenches to do? They carry it out in bundles to the roadside, and the cart brings it away."
"Well, we landowners can't manage well with our labourers," said Levin, handing him a glass of tea.
"Thank you," said the old man,
and he took the glass, but refused sugar, pointing to a lump he had left.
"They're ruination," said he. "Look at Shevatsky, for instance. We know what the land's like. Excellent. Yet there's not much of a crop to boast of. It's not looked after enough. That's all it is."
"But you work your land with hired labourers?"
"We're all peasants together. We supervise everything ourselves. If a man's no good, he can go, and we can manage by ourselves.
"Father, Finnegan needs some tar," said the young woman in the galoshes, coming in.
"Yes, yes. That's so it is, sir," said the old man,
and getting up he crossed himself deliberately, thanked Levin, and went out. When Levin went into the kitchen to call his coachman, he saw the whole family at dinner. The women were standing up, serving. The young, sturdy-looking son was telling something funny with his mouth full of kasha, and they were all laughing. The woman in the galoshes, who was pouring cabbage soup into a bowl, laughing most merrily of all. Very probably the good-looking face of the young woman in the galoshes had a good deal to do with the impression of well-being this peasant household made upon Levin, but the impression was so strong that Levin could never get rid of it. And all the way from the old peasant's to Shiavsky's, he kept recalling this peasant farm as though there were something in this impression that demanded his special attention. Chapter 26. Shiavsky was the marshal of nobility of his district. He was 5 years older than Levin, and had long been married. His sister-in-law, a young girl Levin liked very much, lived in his house, and Levin knew that Shiavsky and his wife would have greatly liked to marry the girl to him. He knew this with certainty, as so-called eligible young men always know it, though he could never have brought himself to speak of it to anyone. And he knew, too, that although he wanted to get married, and although by every token this very attractive girl would make an excellent wife, he could no more have married her, even if he had not been in love with Kitty Shestchabatskaya, than he could have flown up to the sky. And this knowledge poisoned the pleasure he had hoped to find in the visit to Shiavsky. On getting Shiavsky's letter with the invitation for shooting, Levin had immediately thought of this, but in spite of it, he had made up his mind that this idea of Shiavsky's intentions was based on his own groundless supposition, and so he would go all the same. Besides, at the bottom of his heart, he had a desire to test himself in regard to this girl. Shiavsky's home life was exceedingly pleasant, and Shiavsky himself, the best type of man, taking part in local affairs that Levin knew was very interesting to him. Shiavsky was one of those people, always a source of wonder to Levin, whose convictions, very logical, though never original, go one way by themselves, while their life, exceedingly definite and firm in its direction, goes its way quite apart and almost always in direct contradiction to their convictions. Shiavsky was an extremely liberal man. He despised the nobility, and believed the mass of nobility to be secretly in favour of serfdom, concealing their views only because of cowardice. He regarded Russia as a doomed country, like Turkey, and the government of Russia as so bad that he never permitted himself to criticise its doings seriously. And yet he was a functionary of that government, and a model marshal of nobility. When he drove about, he always wore the cockade of office and the cap with the red band. He considered human life tolerable only abroad, and went abroad to stay at every opportunity, and at the same time he carried on a complex and improved system of agriculture in Russia, and with extreme interest followed everything and knew everything that was being done in Russia. He considered the Russian peasant as occupying a stage of development intermediate between the ape and man, and at the same time in the local assemblies no one was readier to shake hands with the peasants and listen to their opinion. He believed in neither God nor the devil, but was much concerned about the question of the improvement of the clergy and the maintenance of their revenues, and took special trouble to keep up the church in his village. On the woman question, he was on the side of the extreme advocates of complete liberty for women, and especially their right to labour. But he lived with his wife on such terms that their affectionate childless home was the admiration of everyone, and he arranged his wife's life so that she did nothing, and could do nothing but share her husband's efforts to make her time pass as happily and as agreeably as possible. If it had not been a characteristic of Levin's to put the most favourable interpretation on people, Shiavsky's character would have presented no doubt or difficulty to him. He would have said to himself, "A fool or a scoundrel," and everything would have seemed clear. But he couldn't say "a fool," because Shiavsky was unmistakably intelligent and, moreover, a highly cultivated man who was exceptionally modest concerning his culture. There wasn't a subject he didn't know something about, but he didn't display his knowledge except when he was compelled to do so.
Still less could Levin say that he was a scoundrel. Shiavsky was unmistakably an honest, good-hearted, sensible man, who worked cheerfully, keenly, and perseveringly at his work. He was held in high honour by everyone about him, and certainly had never consciously done, and was indeed incapable of doing, anything base. Levin tried to understand him, and couldn't understand him, and looked at him and his life as at a living enigma. Levin and he were very friendly, and so Levin used to venture to sound out Shiavsky, to try to get at the very foundation of his view of life, but it was always in vain. Every time Levin tried to penetrate beyond the outer chambers of Shiavsky's mind, which were hospitably open to all, he noticed that Shiavsky was slightly disconcerted. Faint signs of alarm were visible in his eyes, as though he was afraid Levin would understand him, and he would give him a kindly, good-humoured rebuff. Just now, since his disenchantment with farming, Levin was particularly glad to stay with Shiavsky. Apart from the fact that the sight of this happy and affectionate couple, so pleased with themselves and everyone else, and their comfortable home, always had a cheering effect on Levin. He felt a longing, now that he was so dissatisfied with his own life, to get at that secret in Shiavsky that gave him such clearness, definiteness, and courage. Moreover, Levin knew that at Shiavsky's he would meet the landowners of the neighbourhood, and it was particularly interesting for him just now to hear and take part in those rural conversations concerning crops, labourers' wages, and so on, which, he was aware, are conventionally regarded as something beneath dignity, but which seemed to him just now to constitute the one subject of importance. It was not, perhaps, of importance in the days of serfdom, and it may not be of importance in England. In both cases the conditions of agriculture are firmly established, but among us now, when everything has been turned upside down and is only just taking shape, the question of what form these conditions will take is the one question of importance in Russia, thought Levin. The shooting turned out to be worse than Levin had expected. The marsh was dry, and there were no snipe at all. He walked about the whole day, and brought back only 3 birds. But to make up for that, he brought back, as he always did from shooting, an excellent appetite, excellent spirits, and that keen intellectual mood which with him always accompanied violent physical exertion. And while out shooting, when he seemed to be thinking of nothing at all, suddenly the old man and his family kept coming back to his mind, and the impression of them seemed to claim not merely his attention, but also the solution of some question connected with them. In the evening, at tea, 2 landowners who had come about some business connected with a wardship were present, and the interesting conversation Levin had been looking forward to sprang up. Levin was sitting beside his hostess at the tea-table, and was obliged to keep up a conversation with her and her sister, who was sitting opposite him. Madame Shevskaya was a round-faced, fair-haired, rather short woman, all smiles and dimples. Levin tried, through her, to get at a solution of the weighty enigma her husband presented to his mind, but he had not complete freedom of ideas, because he was in an agony of embarrassment. This agony of embarrassment was due to the fact that the sister-in-law was wearing a dress specially put on, he thought, for his benefit, cut particularly low in the shape of a trapeze on her white bosom. This square opening, in spite of the bosom's being very white, or just because it was very white, deprived Levin of the full use of his faculties. He imagined, probably mistakenly, that this low-necked bodice had been made on his account, and felt that he had no right to look at it, and tried not to look at it. But he felt that he was to blame for the very fact of the low-necked bodice having been made. It seemed to Levin that he had deceived someone, that he ought to explain something, but that to explain it was impossible, and for that reason he was continually blushing, was ill at ease and awkward. His awkwardness infected the pretty sister-in-law, too. But their hostess appeared not to observe this, and kept purposely drawing her into the conversation. "You say," she said, pursuing the subject that had been started, "that my husband cannot be interested in what's Russian. It's quite the contrary. He's always in cheerful spirits abroad, but not as he is here. Here he feels in his proper place. He's so much to do, and he has the faculty of interesting himself in everything. Oh, you've not been to see our school, have you?
I've seen it. The little house covered with ivy, isn't it?
Yes, that's Nastia's work, she said, indicating her sister.
You teach in it yourself? Asked Levin, trying to look above the open neck, but feeling that wherever he looked in that direction he would see it.
Yes, I used to teach in it myself, and do teach still, but we have a first-rate schoolmistress now, and we've started gymnastic exercises.
No, thank you, I won't have any more tea, said Levin. And conscious of doing a rude thing, but incapable of continuing the conversation, he got up, blushing. I hear a very interesting conversation, he added, and walked to the other end of the table, where Shiavsky was sitting with the two gentlemen of the neighbourhood. Shiavsky was sitting sideways, with one elbow on the table and a cup in one hand, while with the other hand he gathered up his beard, held it to his nose, and let it drop again as though he were smelling it. His brilliant black eyes were looking straight at the excited country gentleman with grey whiskers, and apparently he derived amusement from his remarks. The gentleman was complaining of the peasants. It was evident to Levin that Shiavsky knew an answer to this gentleman's complaints, which would at once demolish his whole contention, but that in his position he couldn't give utterance to this answer, and listened, not without pleasure, to the landowner's comic speeches. The gentleman with the grey moustache was obviously an inveterate adherent of serfdom, and a devoted agriculturalist, who had lived all his life in the country. Levin saw proofs of this in his dress, in the old-fashioned threadbare coat, obviously not his everyday attire, in his shrewd, deep-set eyes, in his idiomatic, fluent Russian, in the imperious tone that had become habitual from long use, and in the resolute gestures of his large, red, sunburned hands, with an old engagement ring on the little finger.
Chapter 27
If only I'd the heart to give up what's been set going. Such a lot of trouble wasted. I'd turn my back on the whole business, sell it all, go off like Nikolai Ivanovich to hear La Belle Hélène, said the landowner, a pleasant smile lighting up his shrewd old face. But you see, you don't give it up, said Nikolai Ivanovich Shiavsky, so there must be some advantages. The only advantage is that I live in my own house, neither bought nor rented. Besides, one keeps hoping the people will learn sense. Though instead of that, you'd never believe it. The drunkenness, the debauchery. They keep chopping and changing their bits of land. Not a sight of a horse or a cow. The peasant's dying of hunger, but just go and take him on as a labourer. He'll do his best to do mischief, and then bring you up before the justice of the peace.
But then you make complaints to the justice, too, said Shiavsky.
I lodge complaints? Not for anything in the world. Such gossip that one would have cause to regret it. At the mill, for instance, they pocketed the advance money and made off. What did the justice do? Why, acquitted them. Nothing keeps them in line but their own communal court and their village elder. He'll flog them in the good old style. But for that, there'd be no choice but to give it all up and run away.
Obviously, the landowner was teasing Shiavsky, who, far from resenting it, was apparently amused by it.
But you see, we manage our land without such extreme measures, said he, smiling. Levin and I and this gentleman.
He indicated the other landowner.
Yes, the thing's done at Mikhail Petrovich's, but ask him how it's done. "'Do you call that a rational system?' said the landowner, obviously rather proud of the word rational.
"'My system's very simple,' said Mikhail Petrovich. "'Thank God. All my management rests on getting the money ready for the autumn taxes, and the peasants come to me. Father, master, help us.' "'Well, the peasants are all one's neighbours. One feels for them. So one advances them a third, but one says, "'Remember, boys, I've helped you.' And you must help me when I need it, whether it's the sowing of the oats, or the hay-cutting, or the harvest. And, well, one agrees, so much for each taxpayer. Though there are dishonest ones among them, too, it's true.
Levin, who had long been familiar with these patriarchal methods, exchanged glances with Shiavsky, and interrupted Mikhail Petrovitch, turning again to the gentleman with the grey moustache.
"Then what do you think?" he asked. "What system is one to adopt nowadays?"
"Why, manage like Mikhail Petrovitch, or let the land for half the crop, or for rent to the peasants. That one can do. Only that's just how the general prosperity of the country is being ruined. Where the land with serf labour and good management gave a yield of 9 to 1, on the half-crop system it yields 3 to 1. Russia has been ruined by the emancipation."
Shiavsky looked with smiling eyes at Levin, and even made a faint gesture of irony to him. But Levin didn't think the landowner's words absurd. He understood them better than he did Shiavsky. A great deal more of what the gentleman with the grey moustache said to show in what way Russia was ruined by the emancipation struck him indeed as very true, new to him, and quite incontestable.
The landowner unmistakably spoke his own individual thought, a thing that rarely happens, and a thought to which he had been brought not by a desire of finding some exercise for an idle brain, but a thought which had grown up out of the conditions of his life, which he had brooded over in the solitude of his village and had considered in every aspect.
"The point is, don't you see, that progress of every sort is made only by the use of authority,"
he said, evidently wishing to show he was not without culture.
"Take the reforms of Peter, of Catherine, of Alexander. Take European history. And progress in agriculture more than anything else, the potato, for instance, that was introduced among us by force. The wooden plough, too, wasn't always used. It was introduced maybe in the days of medieval Russia, but it was probably brought in by force. Now, in our own day, we landowners in the serf times used various improvements in our husbandry. Drying machines, threshing machines, and carting manure, and all the modern implements, all that we brought into use by our authority, and the peasants opposed it at first, and ended by imitating us. Now, by the abolition of serfdom, we have been deprived of our authority, and so our husbandry, where it had been raised to a high level, is bound to sink to the most savage, primitive condition. Well, that's how I see it."
"But why so? If it's rational, you'll be able to keep up the same system with hired labour," said Shiavsky.
"We've no power over them. With whom am I going to work the system, allow me to ask?"
"There it is, the labour force, the chief element in agriculture," thought Levin.
"With labourers?" "The labourers won't work well, and won't work with good implements. Our labourer can do nothing but get drunk like a pig, and when he's drunk he ruins everything you give him. He makes the horses ill with too much water, cuts good harness, barters the tyres off the wheels for drink, drops a bolt into the threshing machine so as to break it. He loathes the sight of anything that's not after his fashion. And that's how it is that the whole level of husbandry has fallen. Lands gone out of cultivation, overgrown with weeds, or divided among the peasants. And where millions of bushels were raised, you get 100,000. The wealth of the country has decreased. If the same thing had been done, but with care, that—"
And he proceeded to unfold his own scheme of emancipation, by means of which these drawbacks might have been avoided. This didn't interest Levin, but when he had finished, Levin went back to his first proposition, and addressing Shiavsky, he tried to draw him into expressing his serious opinion.
"That the standard of culture is falling, and that with our present relations to the peasants there is no possibility of farming on a rational system to yield a profit, that's perfectly true," said he. "I don't believe it," Shiavsky replied quite seriously. "All I see is we don't know how to cultivate the land, and that our system of agriculture in the serf days was by no means too high, but too low. We have no machines, no good stock, no efficient supervision. We don't even know how to keep accounts."
Ask any landowner. He won't be able to tell you what crop's profitable and what's not.
"Italian bookkeeping," said the gentleman of the grey moustache ironically.
"You may keep your books as you like, but if the peasants spoil everything for you, there won't be any profit." Why do they spoil things? An inferior threshing machine of Russian quality, they'll break. But my steam threshing machine, they don't break. A wretched Russian nag, they'll ruin. But keep good dray horses or cart horses, they won't ruin them. And so it is all around. We must raise our farming to a higher level. Oh, if one only had the means to do it, Nikolai Ivanovitch. It's all very well for you, but for me, with a son to keep at the university, boys to be educated at the high school, how am I going to buy these dray horses? Well, that's what banks are for. To get what's left me sold by auction? No, thank you.
I don't agree that it's necessary or possible to raise the level of agriculture still higher, said Levin. I devote myself to it, and I have means, but I can do nothing.
As to the banks, I don't know to whom they're any good. But for my part, anyway, whatever I've spent money on in the way of husbandry, it's been a loss. Stock? A loss. Machinery? A loss. That's true enough, the gentleman with the grey moustache chimed in, actually laughing with satisfaction.
And I'm not the only one, pursued Levin. I mix with all the neighbouring landowners who are cultivating their land on a rational system. They all, with rare exceptions, are doing so at a loss.
Come, tell us. How does your land do?
Does it pay? Said Levin. And at once in Shuyavsky's eyes, he detected that fleeting expression of alarm which he had noticed whenever he had tried to penetrate beyond the outer chambers of Shuyavsky's mind. Moreover, this question on Levin's part was not quite in good faith. Madame Shuyavskaya had just told him at tea that they had that summer invited a German expert in bookkeeping from Moscow, who, for a consideration of 500 rubles, had investigated the management of their property, and found that it was costing them a loss of 3,000-odd rubles. She didn't remember the precise sum, but it appeared that the German had worked it out to the fraction of a kopeck. The grey-moustached landowner smiled at the mention of the profits of Shuyavsky farming, obviously aware how much gain his neighbour and marshal was likely to be making.
"Possibly it doesn't pay," answered Shuyavsky. "That merely proves either that I'm a bad manager or that I've sunk my capital to increase my rents."
"Oh, rent!" Levin cried with horror.
"Rent there may be in Europe, where land has been improved by the labour put into it. But with us all, the land is deteriorating from the labour put into it. In other words, they're working it out, so there's no question of rent."
"How no rent?
It's a natural law."
"Then we're outside the law. Rent explains nothing for us, but simply confuses us.
No, tell me, how can there be a theory of rent?
Will you have some sour milk? Masha, pass us some sour milk or raspberries."
He turned to his wife.
"The raspberries are lasting extraordinarily late this year."
And in the happiest frame of mind, Shuyavsky got up and walked off, apparently supposing the conversation to have ended at the very point when to Levin it seemed it was only just beginning. Having lost his antagonist, Levin continued the conversation with the grey-moustached landowner, trying to prove to him that all the difficulty arises from the fact that we don't find out the peculiarities and habits of our labourers. But the landowner, like all men who think independently and in isolation, was slow in absorbing any other person's ideas, and remained particularly partial to his own. He insisted that the Russian peasant is a pig, and likes piggishness, and that to get him out of his piggishness, one must have authority, and there is none. One must have the stick, and we have become so liberal that we have all of a sudden replaced the stick that served us for 1,000 years with lawyers and model prisons, where the worthless, stinking peasant is fed on good soup and has a fixed allowance of cubic feet of air. "What makes you think," said Levin, trying to get back to the question, "that it is impossible to find some relation with the labourer in which the labour would become productive?"
"That never could be so with the Russian peasantry. We've no power over 'em," answered the landowner. "How can new conditions be found?" asked Shuyavsky. Having eaten some sour milk and lit a cigarette, he came back to the discussion. "All possible relations to the labour force have been defined and studied," he said. "The relic of barbarism, the primitive commune with mutual guarantee, will disappear by itself. Serfdom has been abolished. There remains nothing but free labour, and its forms are fixed and ready-made and must be adopted. Permanent hands, day labourers, farmers, you can't get out of those forms.
But Europe is dissatisfied with these forms.
Dissatisfied and seeking new ones, and will find them in all probability.
That's just what I mean, answered Levin. Why shouldn't we seek them for ourselves?
Because it would be just like inventing afresh the means for constructing railways.
They are ready, invented. But if they don't do for us, if they're stupid, said Levin. And again he detected the expression of alarm in the eyes of Shiavsky.
Oh, yes, we'll bury the world under our caps. We've found the secret Europe was seeking. I've heard all that, but forgive me. Do you know all that's been done in Europe on the question of the organization of labor?
No, very little.
That question is now absorbing the best minds in Europe, the Schulze-Delitzsch movement. And then all this enormous amount of literature on the labor question of the most liberal Lassalle trend, the Mulhausen system. Well, that's a fact by now, as you're probably aware.
I have some idea of it, but very vague.
No. You only say that. No doubt you know all about it as well as I do. I'm not a professor of sociology, of course, but it interested me. And really, if it interests you, you ought to study it.
But what conclusions have they come to?
Excuse me.
The two neighbours had risen. And Shiavsky, once more checking Levin in his inconvenient habit of peeping into what was beyond the outer chambers of his mind, went to see his guests out. Chapter 28 Levin was insufferably bored that evening with the ladies. He was stirred as he had never been before by the idea that the dissatisfaction he was feeling with his system of managing his land was not an exceptional case, but the general condition of things in Russia, that the organization of some relation of the laborers to the soil in which they would work, as with the peasant he had met on his way to the Shiavskys, was not a dream, but a problem which must be solved. And it seemed to him that the problem could be solved, and that he ought to try and solve it. After saying good night to the ladies, and promising to stay the whole of the next day, so as to make an expedition on horseback with them to see an interesting ruin in the Crown Forest, Levin went, before going to bed, into his host's study to get the books on the labour question that Shiavsky had offered him. Shiavsky's study was a huge room, surrounded by bookcases, and with two tables in it. One, a massive writing table, standing in the middle of the room, and the other, a round table, covered with recent issues of reviews and journals in different languages, ranged like the rays of a star round the lamp. On the writing table was a stand of drawers, marked with gold lettering, and full of papers of various sorts. Shiavsky took out the books and sat down in a rocking chair.
"What are you looking at there?" he said to Levin,
who was standing at the round table looking through the reviews.
"Oh, yes, there's a very interesting article here," said Shiavsky of the review Levin was holding in his hand. "It appears," he went on with eager interest, "that Frederick was not, after all, the person chiefly responsible for the partition of Poland. It is proved."
And with his characteristic clearness, he summed up those new, very important and interesting revelations. Although Levin was engrossed at the moment by his ideas about the problem of the land, he wondered, as he heard Shiavsky, what is there inside him, and why? Why is he interested in the partition of Poland?
When Shiavsky had finished, Levin couldn't help asking, well, and what then?
But there was nothing to follow. It was simply interesting that it had been proved to be so-and-so. But Shiavsky didn't explain, and saw no need to explain why it was interesting to him.
"Yes, but I was very much interested by your irritable neighbour," said Levin, sighing. "He's a clever fellow, and said a lot that was true." "Oh, get along with you. An inveterate supporter of serfdom at heart, like all of them," said Shiavsky.
"Whose marshal you are."
"Yes. Only I marshal them in the other direction," said Shiavsky, laughing. "'I'll tell you what interests me very much,' said Levin. "'He's right that our system, that is to say, of rational farming, has failed, "'that the only thing that succeeds is the money-lender system, "'like that meat-looking gentleman's, or else the very simplest... "'Whose fault is it?'
"'Our own, of course. "'Besides, it's not true that it doesn't succeed. "'It does with Vasilchikov.
"'A factory?'
"'But I really don't know what it is you're surprised at.
"'The people are at such a low stage of rational and moral development "'that it's obvious they're bound to oppose everything that's strange to them. "'In Europe, a rational system succeeds because the people are educated. "'It follows that we must educate the people, that's all.'
"'Well, how are we to educate the people?'
"'To educate the people, three things are needed. "'Schools, and schools, and schools.'
But you said yourself that people are at a low stage of material development. What help are schools for that?
Do you know, you remind me of the story of the advice given to the sick man. You should try a laxative.
Taken.
Worse. Try leeches. Tried them.
Worse.
Well then, there's nothing left but to pray to God.
Tried it.
Worse. That's just how it is with us. I say political economy, you say worse. I say socialism, worse. Education, worse.
But how do schools help matters?
They give the peasant fresh needs.
Well, that's a thing I've never understood,
Levin replied with heat.
In what way are schools going to help the people to improve their material position? You say schools, education will give them fresh needs.
So much the worse, since they won't be capable of satisfying them.
And in what way a knowledge of addition and subtraction and the catechism is going to improve their material condition, I never could make out.
The day before yesterday, I met a peasant woman in the evening with a little baby, and asked her where she was going. She said she was going to the village sorceress. Her boy had screaming fits, so she was taking him to be doctored. I asked, why? How does the wise woman cure screaming fits?
She puts the child on the hen roost and repeats some charm.
Well, you're saying it yourself.
What's needed to prevent her taking her child to the hen roost to cure it of screaming fits is just...
Shavsky said, smiling good-humouredly.
Oh, no, said Levin with annoyance. That method of doctoring I merely meant as a simile for doctoring the people with schools.
The people are poor and ignorant.
That we see, as surely as the peasant woman sees the baby is ill because it screams.
But in what way this trouble of poverty and ignorance is to be cured by schools is as incomprehensible as how the hen roost affects the screaming.
What has to be cured is what makes him poor.
Well, in that, at least, you're in agreement with Spencer, whom you dislike so much. He says, too, that education may be the consequence of greater prosperity and comfort, of more frequent washing, as he says, but not of being able to read and write.
Well, then, I'm very glad, or the contrary, very sorry, that I'm in agreement with Spencer.
Only I've known it a long while. Schools can do no good. What will do good is an economic organization in which the people will become richer, will have more leisure, and then there will be schools.
Still, all over Europe now, schools are obligatory.
And how far do you agree with Spencer yourself about it? Asked Levin. But there was a gleam of alarm in Shiavsky's eyes, and he said, smiling,
No, that screaming fit story is positively marvellous. Did you really hear it yourself?
Levin saw that he was not to discover the connection between this man's life and his thoughts. Obviously, he didn't care in the least what his reasoning led him to. All he wanted was the process of reasoning. And he didn't like it when the process of reasoning brought him into a blind alley. That was the only thing he disliked, and avoided by changing the conversation to something agreeable and amusing. All the impressions of the day, beginning with the impression made by the old peasant, which served, as it were, as the fundamental basis of all the conceptions and ideas of the day, threw Levin into violent excitement. This dear, good Shiavsky, keeping a stock of ideas simply for social purposes, obviously having some other principles hidden from Levin, while with the crowd, whose name is Legion, he guided public opinion by ideas he didn't share. That irascible country gentleman, perfectly correct in the conclusions that he had been worried into by life, but wrong in his exasperation against a whole class, and that the best class in Russia, his own dissatisfaction with the work he had been doing, and the vague hope of finding a remedy for all this. All this was blended in a sense of inner turmoil and anticipation of some solution near at hand. Left alone in the room assigned him, lying on a spring mattress that yielded unexpectedly at every movement of his arm or his leg, Levin didn't fall asleep for a long while. Not one conversation with Siavsky, though he had said a great deal that was clever, had interested Levin, but the conclusions of the irascible landowner required consideration. Levin couldn't help recalling every word he had said, and in imagination amending his own replies. "Yes, I should have said to him, 'You say that our husbandry does not succeed because the peasant hates improvements, and that they must be forced on him by authority. If no system of husbandry succeeded at all without these improvements, you would be quite right. But the only system that does succeed is when the labourer is working in accordance with his habits, just as on the old peasant's land halfway here. Your and our general dissatisfaction with the system shows that either we or the labourers are to blame. We have gone our way, the European way, a long while, without asking ourselves about the qualities of our labour force. Let us try to look upon the labour force not as the ideal labour force, but as the Russian peasant with his instincts, and we shall arrange our system of culture in accordance with that. Imagine, I should have said to him, that you have the same system as the old peasant has, that you have found means of making your labourers take an interest in the success of the work, and have found the happy mean in the way of improvements which they will admit. And you will, without exhausting the soil, get twice or three times the yield you got before. Divide it in halves. Give half as the share of labour. The surplus left you will be greater, and the share of labour will be greater too. And to do this, one must lower the standard of husbandry and interest the labourers in its success. How to do this? That's a matter of detail, but undoubtedly it can be done. This idea threw Levin into a great excitement. He didn't sleep half the night, thinking over in detail the putting of his idea into practice. He had not intended to leave the next day, but he now determined to go home early in the morning. Besides, the sister-in-law with her low-necked bodice aroused in him a feeling akin to shame and remorse for some utterly base action. Most important of all, he must get back without delay. He would have to make haste to put his new project to the peasants before the sowing of the winter wheat, so that the sowing might be undertaken on a new basis. He had made up his mind to revolutionize his whole system. Chapter 29. The carrying out of Levin's plan presented many difficulties, but he struggled on, doing his utmost, and attained a result which, though not what he desired, was enough to enable him, without self-deception, to believe that the attempt was worth the trouble. One of the chief difficulties was that the process of cultivating the land was in full swing, that it was impossible to stop everything and begin it all again from the beginning, and the machine had to be overhauled while in motion. When on the evening that he arrived home, he informed the bailiff of his plans, the latter, with visible pleasure, agreed with what he said, so long as he was pointing out that all that had been done up to that time was stupid and useless. The bailiff said that he had said so a long while ago, but no heed had been paid him. But as for the proposal made by Levin, to take a part as shareholder with his labourers in each agricultural undertaking, at this the bailiff simply expressed profound despondency, and offered no definite opinion, but began immediately talking of the urgent necessity of carrying the remaining sheaves of rye the next day, and of sending the men out for the second ploughing, so that Levin felt that this was not the time for discussing it. On beginning to talk to the peasants about it, and making a proposition to cede them the land on new terms, he came into collision with the same great difficulty. They were so much absorbed by the current work of the day that they didn't have time to consider the advantages and disadvantages of the proposed scheme. The naive Ivan, the cowherd, seemed completely to grasp Levin's proposal,
that he and his family should take a share of the profits of the dairy farm, and he was in complete sympathy with the plan. But when Levin hinted at the future advantages, Ivan's face expressed alarm and regret that he couldn't hear all he had to say, and he made haste to find himself some task that could not be delayed. He either snatched up the fork to pitch the hay out of the pens, or ran to get water, or cleaned out the manure. Another difficulty lay in the invincible disbelief of the peasant that a landowner's object could be anything else than a desire to squeeze all he could out of them. They were firmly convinced that his real aim, whatever he might say to them, would always be in what he didn't say to them. And they themselves, in giving their opinion, said a great deal, but never said what was their real object. Moreover, Levin felt that the irascible landowner had been right, the peasants made as the first and unalterable condition of any agreement whatever that they should not be forced to any new methods of tillage of any kind, or to use new implements. They agreed that the modern plough ploughed better, that the scarifier did the work more quickly, but they found thousands of reasons that made it out of the question for them to use either of them. And though he had accepted the conviction that he would have to lower the standard of cultivation, he felt sorry to give up improved methods, the advantages of which were so obvious. But in spite of all these difficulties, he got his way, and by autumn the system was working, or so at least it seemed to him. At first, Levin had thought of giving up the whole farming of the land just as it was to the peasants, the labourers, and the bailiff on new conditions of partnership. But he was very soon convinced that this was impossible, and determined to divide it up. The cattle yard, the garden, hayfields and arable land, divided into several parts, had to be made into separate lots. The naive cowherd Ivan, who, Levin thought, understood the matter better than any of them, collecting together a gang of workers, principally of his own family, became a partner in the dairy farm. A distant part of the estate, a tract of waste land that had lain fallow for 8 years, was, with the help of the clever carpenter Fyodor Razunov, taken by 6 families of peasants on new conditions of partnership, and the peasant Shurayev took the management of all the vegetable gardens on the same terms. The remainder of the land was still worked on the old system, but these 3 associated partnerships were the first step to a new organization of the whole, and they completely took up Levin's time. It is true that in the dairy farm things went no better than before, and Ivan strenuously opposed warm housing for the cows and butter made of fresh cream, affirming that cows require less food if kept cold, and that butter is more profitable made from sour cream. And he asked for wages just as under the old system, and took not the slightest interest in the fact that the money he received was not wages, but an advance out of his future share in the profits. It's true that Fyodor Razunov's group didn't plough the ground twice before sowing, as had been agreed, justifying themselves on the plea that the time was too short. It is true that the peasants of the same group, though they had agreed to work the land on new conditions, always spoke of the land not as held in partnership, but as rented for half the crop, and more than once the peasants and Razunov himself said to Levin, "If you would take rent for the land, it would save you trouble, and we would be more free." Moreover, the same peasants kept putting off, on various excuses, the building of a cattle yard and barn on the land as agreed upon, and delayed doing it till winter. It's true that Shurayev would have liked to sublease the vegetable gardens in small lots to the peasants. He evidently quite misunderstood, and apparently intentionally misunderstood, the conditions upon which the land had been given to him. Often, too, talking to the peasants and explaining to them all the advantages of the plan, Levin felt that they heard nothing but the sound of his voice, and were firmly resolved, whatever he might say, not to let themselves be taken in. He felt this especially when he talked to the cleverest of the peasants, Razunov, and detected the gleam in his eyes which showed so plainly both ironical amusement at Levin and the firm conviction that if anyone were to be taken in, it would not be he, Razunov. But in spite of all this, Levin thought the system worked, and that by keeping accounts strictly and insisting on his own way, he would prove to them in the future the advantages of the arrangement, and then the system would work automatically. These matters, together with the management of the land still left on his hands, and the indoor work over his book, so engrossed Levin the whole summer
that he scarcely ever went out shooting. At the end of August, he heard from their servant who had brought back the saddle that the Oblonskys had gone away to Moscow. He felt that in not answering Darya Alexandrovna's letter, he had, by his rudeness, of which he couldn't think without a flush of shame, burned his ships, and that he would never go and see them again. He'd been just as rude with the Shiavskys, leaving them without saying goodbye. But he would never go to see them again, either. He didn't care about that now. The business of reorganizing the farming of his land absorbed him as completely as though there would never be anything else in his life. He read the books lent him by Shiavsky, and copying out what he didn't have, he read books on both the economic and the socialistic aspects of the subject. But, as he had anticipated, found nothing bearing on the scheme he had undertaken. In the books on political economy, in Mill, for instance, whom he studied first with great ardour, hoping every minute to find an answer to the questions that were engrossing him, he found laws deduced from the condition of the land culture in Europe. But he didn't see why these laws, which didn't apply in Russia, must be general. He saw just the same thing in the books on socialism. Either they were the beautiful but impracticable fantasies which had fascinated him when he was a student, or they were attempts at improving, rectifying the economic position in which Europe was placed, with which the system of land tenure in Russia had nothing in common. Political economy told him that the laws by which the wealth of Europe had been developed, and was developing, were universal and unvarying. Socialism told him that development along these lines leads to ruin. And neither of them gave an answer, or even a hint, in reply to the question of what he, Levin, and all the Russian peasants and landowners were to do with their millions of hands and millions of acres, to make them as productive as possible for the common good. Having once taken up the subject, he read conscientiously everything bearing on it, and intended in the autumn to go abroad to study land systems on the spot, in order that he might not, on this question, be confronted with what so often met him on various subjects. Often, just as he was beginning to understand the idea in the mind of anyone he was talking to, and was beginning to explain his own, he would suddenly be told, "But Kaufmann, but Jones, but Dubois, but Michelli, you haven't read them. They've thrashed that question out thoroughly." He saw now distinctly that Kaufmann and Michelli had nothing to tell him. He knew what he wanted. He saw that Russia has splendid land, splendid labourers, and that in certain cases, as at the peasants on the way to the Shiavskys, the produce raised by the labourers and the land is great. In the majority of cases, when capital is applied in the European way, the produce is small, and that this simply arises from the fact that the labourers want to work, and work well only in their own peculiar way, and that this antagonism is not incidental, but invariable, and has its roots in the national spirit. He thought that the Russian people, whose task it was to colonize and cultivate vast tracts of unoccupied land, consciously adhered till all their land was occupied to the methods suitable to their purpose, and that their methods were by no means so bad as was generally supposed. And he wanted to prove this theoretically in his book, and practically on his land. Chapter 30. At the end of September, the timber had been carted for building the cattle yard on the land that had been rented to the Association of Peasants, and the butter from the cows was sold, and the profits divided. In practice, the system worked wonderfully, or at least so it seemed to Levin. In order to work out the whole subject, theoretically, and to complete his book, which in Levin's daydreams was not merely to effect a revolution in political economy, but to annihilate that science entirely, and to lay the foundation of a new science of the relation of the people to the soil, all that was left to do was to make a tour abroad, and to study on the spot all that had been done in the same direction, and to collect conclusive evidence that all that had been done there was not what was wanted. Levin was only waiting for the delivery of his wheat to receive the money for it and go abroad. But the rains began, preventing the harvesting of the corn and potatoes left in the fields, and putting a stop to all work, even to the delivery of the wheat. The mud was impassable along the roads. Two mills were carried away, and the weather got worse and worse. On September the 30th, the sun came out in the morning, and hoping for fine weather, Levin began making final preparations for his journey. He gave orders for the wheat to be delivered, sent the bailiff to the merchant to get the money owed him, and went out himself to give some final instructions on the estate before setting off. Having finished all his business, soaked through with the streams of water which kept running down the leather behind his neck and his high boots, but in the keenest and most confident temper, Levin returned homeward in the evening. The weather had become worse than ever toward the evening. The hail lashed the drenched mare so cruelly that she went along sideways, shaking her head and ears. But Levin was all right under his hood, and he looked cheerfully about him at the muddy streams running under the wheels, at the drops hanging on every bare twig, at the whiteness of the patch of unmelted hailstones on the planks of the bridge, at the thick layer of still juicy, fleshy leaves that lay heaped up about the naked elm tree. In spite of the gloominess of nature around him, he felt peculiarly elated. The talks he had been having with the peasants in the further village had shown that they were beginning to get used to their new position. The old servant to whose hut he had gone to get dry evidently approved of Levin's plan, and of his own accord proposed to enter the partnership by the purchase of cattle. "I need only continue stubbornly on toward my aim, and I will attain my end," thought Levin, "and it's something to work and take trouble for. This is not a matter of myself individually. The question of the public welfare enters into it. The whole system of culture, the chief element in the condition of the people, must be completely transformed. Instead of poverty, general prosperity and content. Instead of hostility, harmony and unity of interests. In short, a bloodless revolution, but a revolution of the greatest magnitude, beginning in the little circle of our district, then the province, then Russia, then the whole world. Because a just idea cannot but be fruitful. Yes, it's a name worth working for. And it's being me, Kostya Levin, who went to a ball in a black tie and was refused by the Sheshchabatskaya girl, and who was intrinsically such a pitiful, worthless creature. That proves nothing. I feel sure Franklin felt just as worthless, and he too had no faith in himself when summing himself up. That means nothing. And he too, most likely, had an Agafia Mikhailovna to whom he confided his secrets. Musing on such thoughts, Levin reached home in the darkness. The bailiff, who had been to the merchant, had come back and brought part of the money for the wheat. An agreement had been made with the old servant, and on the road the bailiff had learned that everywhere the corn was still standing in the fields, so that his 160 shocks, still in the fields, were nothing in comparison with the losses of others. After dinner, Levin was sitting, as he usually did, in an armchair with a book, and as he read, he went on thinking of the journey before him in connection with his book. Today, all the significance of his book rose before him with special distinctness, and whole periods ranged themselves in his mind in illustration of his theories. "I must write that down," he thought. "That should make a brief introduction, which I thought unnecessary before." He got up to go to his writing table, and Laska, lying at his feet, got up too, stretching and looking at him as though to inquire where to go. But he had no time to write it down, for the head peasants had come to see him, and Levin went out into the hall to receive them. After giving directions about the labours of the next day and seeing all the peasants who had business with him, Levin went back to his study and began to work. Laska lay under the table. Agafia Mikhailovna settled herself in her place with her knitting. After writing for a little while, Levin suddenly thought with exceptional vividness of Kitty, her refusal, and their last meeting. He got up and began walking about the room.
"What's the use of being dreary?" said Agafia Mikhailovna. "Come, why do you stay at home? You ought to go to some spa, especially now that you're ready for the journey."
"Well, I am going away the day after tomorrow, Agafia Mikhailovna. I must finish my work."
"There, there, your work, you say. As if you hadn't done enough for the peasants. Why, as it is, they're saying, your master will be getting some honour from the Tsar for it. Indeed, and it is a strange thing. Why need you worry about the peasants?
I'm not worrying about them. I'm doing it for my own good. Agafea Mikhailovna knew every detail of Levin's plans for his land. Levin often put his views before her in all their complexity, and not uncommonly he argued with her and didn't agree with her comments. But on this occasion she entirely misinterpreted what he had said.
"Of one soul's salvation we all know one must think before all else," she said with a sigh. "Parfion Denisitch, now, though he was no scholar, died a death that God grant every one of us," she said, referring to a servant who had died recently. "Took the sacrament and all."
"That's not what I mean," said he. "I mean, I'm acting for my own advantage. It's to my advantage if the peasants do their work better."
"Well, whatever you do, if he's a lazy good-for-nothing, everything will be messed up. If he has a conscience, he'll work. And if not, there's no doing anything." "Oh, come! You say yourself Ivan has begun looking after the cattle better."
"All I say is," answered Agafea Mikhailovna, evidently not speaking at random, but in strict sequence of ideas, "that you should get married. That's what I say."
Agafea Mikhailovna's allusion to the very subject he had just been thinking about hurt and stung him. Levin scowled, and without answering her, he sat down again to his work, repeating to himself all that he'd been thinking about the real significance of that work. Only at intervals he listened in the stillness to the click of Agafea Mikhailovna's needles, and recollecting what he didn't want to remember, he frowned again. At 9 o'clock they heard the bell and the faint vibration of a carriage through the mud.
"Well, here's visitors come to us, and you won't be bored," said Agafea Mikhailovna, getting up and going to the door.
But Levin overtook her. His work was not going well now, and he was glad of a visitor, whoever it might be. Chapter 31. Running halfway down the staircase, Levin caught a sound he knew, a familiar cough in the hall. But he heard it indistinctly through the sound of his own footsteps, and hoped he was mistaken. Then he caught sight of a long, bony, familiar figure, and now it seemed there was no possibility of mistake, and yet he still went on hoping that this tall man, taking off his fur cloak and coughing, was not his brother Nikolai. Levin loved his brother, but being with him was always a torture. Just now, when Levin, under the influence of the thoughts that had come to him, and Agafea Mikhailovna's hint, was in a troubled and uncertain mood, the meeting he had to face with his brother seemed particularly difficult. Instead of a lively, healthy visitor, some outsider who would cheer him up in his uncertain humour, he had to see his brother, who knew him through and through, who would call forth all the thoughts nearest his heart, would force him to show himself fully, and that he was not disposed to do. Angry with himself for so base a feeling, Levin ran into the hall. As soon as he had seen his brother close, this feeling of selfish disappointment vanished instantly and was replaced by pity. Terrible as his brother Nikolai had been before in his emaciation and sickliness, he now looked still more emaciated, still more wasted. He was a skeleton covered by skin. He stood in the hall, jerking his long, thin neck and pulling the scarf off it, and smiled a strange and pitiful smile. When he saw that smile, submissive and humble, Levin felt something clutching at his throat.
"You see, I've come to you," said Nikolai in a thick voice, never for one second taking his eyes off his brother's face. "I've been meaning to for a long while, but I've been sick all the time. Now I'm so much better," he said, rubbing his beard with his big, thin hands.
"Yes, yes," answered Levin. And he felt still more frightened when, kissing him, he felt with his lips the dryness of his brother's skin and saw close to him his big eyes full of a strange light. A few weeks before, Konstantin Levin had written to his brother that through the sale of a small part of the property that had remained undivided, there was a sum of about 2,000 rubles due him as his share. Nikolai said that he had come now to take this money, and, what was more important, to stay a while in the old nest, to get in touch with the earth, so as to renew his strength like the heroes of old for the work that lay before him. In spite of his exaggerated stoop and the emaciation that was so striking from his height, his movements were as rapid and abrupt as ever. Levin led him into his study. His brother, dressed with particular care, a thing he never used to do, combed his thin, lank hair, and, smiling, went upstairs. He was in the most affectionate and good-humoured mood, just as Levin often remembered him in childhood. He even referred to Sergei Ivanovich without rancour. When he saw Agafia Mikhailovna, he made jokes with her and asked about the old servants. The news of the death of Parfen Denisitch made a painful impression on him. A look of fear crossed his face, but he regained his serenity immediately.
"Of course, he was quite old," he said, and changed the subject. "Well, I'll spend a month or two with you, and then I'm off to Moscow. Do you know Miyakov has promised me a place there, and I'm going into the civil service? Now I'm going to arrange my life quite differently," he went on. "You know, I got rid of that woman."
"Maria Nikolaevna?
Why? What for?" "Oh, she was a horrible woman. She caused me all sorts of trouble."
But he didn't say what the trouble was. He couldn't say that he had cast off Maria Mikhailovna because the tea was weak, and above all because she would look after him as though he were an invalid.
"Besides, I want to turn over a new leaf completely now. I've done silly things, of course, like everyone else, but money's the last consideration. I don't regret it. So long as there's health, and my health, thank God, is quite restored."
Levin listened and racked his brains, but could think of nothing to say. Nikolai probably felt the same. He began questioning his brother about his affairs, and Levin was glad to talk about himself, because then he could speak without hypocrisy. He told his brother of his plans and his doings. His brother listened, but evidently he was not interested by it. These two men were so akin, so near each other, that the slightest gesture, the tone of voice, told both more than can be said in words. Both of them now had only one thought, the illness of Nikolai and the nearness of his death, which stifled all else. But neither of them dared to speak of it, and so whatever they said, not uttering the one thought that filled their minds, was all falsehood. Never had Levin been so glad when an evening was over and it was time to go to bed. Never with any outside person, never on any official visit, had he been so unnatural and false as he was that evening. And the consciousness of this unnaturalness, and the remorse he felt at it, made him even more unnatural. He wanted to weep over his dying, dearly beloved brother, and he had to listen and keep on talking of how he meant to live. As the house was damp, and only one bedroom had been kept heated, Levin put his brother to sleep in his own bedroom behind a partition. His brother got into bed, and whether he slept or didn't sleep, he tossed about like a sick man, coughed, and when he couldn't get his throat clear, mumbled something. Sometimes, when his breathing was painful, he said, "Oh, my God!" Sometimes, when he was choking, he muttered angrily, "Oh, hell!" Levin couldn't sleep for a long while, hearing him. His thoughts were of all sorts of things, but the end of all his thoughts was the same. Death. Death, the inevitable end of all, for the first time presented itself to him with irresistible force. And death, which was here in this beloved brother, groaning, half asleep, and from habit calling without distinction on God and the devil, was not so remote as it had hitherto seemed to him. It was in himself, too, he felt that. If not today, tomorrow. If not tomorrow, in 30 years. Wasn't it all the same? And what was this inevitable death? He didn't know, had never thought about it, and what was more, had not the power, had not the courage to think about it.
"I work. I want to do something.
But I had forgotten it must all end. I had forgotten death." He sat on his bed in the darkness, crouched up, hugging his knees, and holding his breath from the strain of thought, he pondered. But the more intensely he thought, the clearer it became to him that it was indubitably so, that in reality, looking upon life, he had forgotten one little facet, that death will come, and all ends. That nothing was even worth beginning, and that there was nothing that could be done about it anyway. Yes, it was awful, but it was so.
"But I'm alive still.
Now what's to be done? What's to be done?" he said in despair. He lit a candle, got up cautiously, and went to the mirror and began looking at his face and hair. Yes, there were grey hairs about his temples. He opened his mouth. His back teeth were beginning to decay. He bared his muscular arms. Yes, there was strength in them. But Nikolai, who lay there breathing with what was left of lungs, had had a strong, healthy body too. And suddenly he recalled how they used to go to bed together as children, and how they waited only till Fyodor Bogdanich was out of the room to fling pillows at each other and laugh. Laugh irrepressibly, so that even their awe of Fyodor Bogdanich couldn't check the effervescing, overbrimming sense of life and happiness. And now that bent, hollow chest, and I, not knowing what will become of me, or wherefore...
Hell! Why do you keep fidgeting? Why don't you go to sleep?
His brother's voice called to him.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sleepy. I've had a good sleep. I'm not in a sweat now. Just see. Feel my shirt. It's not wet, is it?
Levin felt, withdrew behind the screen and put out the candle, but for a long while he couldn't sleep. The question of how to live had hardly begun to grow a little clearer to him when a new, insoluble question presented itself. Death.
Why, he's dying.
Yes, he'll die in the spring, and how can I help him? What can I say to him? What do I know about it? I'd even forgotten that it existed at all. Chapter 32. Levin had long before made the observation that when one is uncomfortable with people from their being excessively amenable and meek, one is apt very soon after to find things intolerable because of their touchiness and irritability. He felt that this was how it would be with his brother. And his brother Nikolai's gentleness did, in fact, not last for long. The very next morning he began to be irritable and seemed to be doing his best to find fault with his brother, attacking him on his tenderest points. Levin felt himself to blame, and couldn't set things right. He felt that if they had both not kept up appearances, but had spoken from the heart, that is to say, had just said what they were thinking and feeling, they would simply have looked into each other's faces, and Konstantin could only have said, "You're dying, you're dying." And Nikolai could only have answered, "I know I'm dying, but I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid." And they could have said nothing more if they had said only what was in their hearts. But life like that was impossible, and so Konstantin tried to do what he had been trying to do all his life, and never could learn to do, though, as far as he could observe, many people knew so well how to do it, and without it there was no living at all. He tried to say what he wasn't thinking, but he felt continually that it had a ring of falsehood, that his brother detected him in it, and was exasperated at it. The third day Nikolai induced his brother to explain his plan to him again, and began not merely attacking it, but intentionally confusing it with communism.
"You've simply borrowed an idea that's not your own, but you've distorted it, and are trying to apply it where it's not applicable. But I tell you, it has nothing to do with it. They deny the justice of property, of capital, of inheritance, while I do not deny this chief stimulus."
Levin felt disgusted at himself for using such words, but ever since he had been engrossed by his work, he had unconsciously come more and more frequently to use words not Russian. "All I want is to regulate labor."
"Which means you've borrowed an idea, stripped it of all that gave it its force, and want to make believe that it's something new,"
said Nikolai, angrily tugging at his necktie. "But my idea has nothing in common..."
"That, anyway,"
said Nikolai Levin with an ironical smile, his eyes flashing malignantly,
"has the charm of, what's one to call it, geometrical symmetry, of clearness, of definiteness. It may be a utopia. But if once one allows the possibility of making of all the past a tabula rasa, a clean slate, no property, no family, then labor would organize itself. But you gain nothing."
"Why do you mix things up? I've never been a communist."
"But I have. And I consider it premature but rational, and it has a future, just like Christianity in its first centuries."
All that I maintain is that the labour force ought to be investigated from the point of view of natural science. That is to say, it ought to be studied, its qualities ascertained.
But that's an utter waste of time. That force finds a certain form of activity itself, according to the stage of its development. There've been slaves first everywhere, then tenants, and we have the sharecrop system, rent and day labourers. What are you trying to find?
Levin suddenly lost his temper at these words, because at the bottom of his heart he was afraid that it was true. True that he was trying to hold the balance even between communism and the existing forms, and that this was hardly possible. I'm trying to find means of working productively for myself and for the labourers. I want to organise, he answered hotly.
You don't want to organise anything. It's simply just as you've been all your life that you want to be original, to show that you are not simply exploiting the peasants, but have some idea in view.
Oh, all right, that's what you think. And let me alone, answered Levin, feeling the muscles of his left cheek twitching uncontrollably.
You've never had, and never have, convictions. All you want is to please your vanity.
Oh, very well, then. Let me alone.
And I will let you alone. And it's high time I did, and go to hell. And I'm very sorry I ever came.
In spite of all Levin's efforts to soothe his brother afterward, Nikolai would listen to nothing he said, declaring that it was better to part. And Konstantin saw that it was simply that life was unbearable to him. Nikolai was just getting ready to go when Konstantin went in to him again and begged him, rather unnaturally, to forgive him if he had hurt his feelings in any way.
Oh, generosity, said Nikolai, and he smiled. If you want to be right, I can give you that satisfaction.
You're right,
but I'm going all the same.
It was only at parting that Nikolai kissed him and said, looking with sudden strangeness and seriousness at his brother,
"Anyway, don't remember evil against me, Kostya."
And his voice quivered. These were the only words that had been spoken sincerely between them. Levin knew that those words meant, "You see and you know that I'm in a bad way, and maybe we shall not see each other again." Levin knew this, and the tears gushed from his eyes. He kissed his brother once more, but he couldn't speak, and knew not what to say. 3 days after his brother's departure, Levin, too, set off for his foreign tour. Happening to meet Shishchobatsky, Kitty's cousin, in the railway train, Levin greatly astonished him by his depression.
"What's the matter with you?" Shishchobatsky asked him.
"Oh, nothing. There's not much happiness in life."
"Not much. You come with me to Paris, instead of to Mulhausen. You shall see how to be happy."
"No, I'm finished with it all. It's time I was dead."
"Well, that's a good one," said Shishchobatsky, laughing. "Why, I'm only just getting ready to begin."
"Yes, I thought the same not long ago, but now I know I shall soon be dead." Levin said what he had genuinely been thinking of late. He saw nothing but death, or the advance toward death, in everything. But his cherished scheme only engrossed him all the more. Life had to be got through somehow till death did come. Darkness had fallen upon everything for him, but just because of this darkness, he felt that the one guiding clue in the darkness was his work, and he clutched it and clung to it with all his strength.